From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Soviet emigre Alexander Slepak. When he left the Soviet Union, he had to leave his family behind. His parents, Vladimir and Maria, are two of the Soviet Union's leading refuseniks. Also today, I speak with singer Dion DiMucci. His hits like Runaround Sue and The Wanderer made him a teenage idol, but his old fans lost track of him when he started recording Christian music. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews the new album from composer and clarinetist John Carter, and television critic David Bianculli reviews Showtime Coast to Coast, the cable network's new variety show. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Alexander Slepak. He was the first member of his family allowed to leave the Soviet Union. His parents, Vladimir and Maria, are two of the country's leading Jewish refuseniks. Alexander is working to get them out. Vladimir and Maria Slepak were founders of the Jewish emigration movement. When they first asked permission to leave the Soviet Union in 1970, they were dismissed from their jobs and were harassed by Soviet officials. A few years later, along with other dissidents, including Anatoly Sharansky, Yuri Orlov, and Elena Bonner, they co-founded a group that monitored Soviet human rights violations. My guest Alexander Slepak was allowed to leave the Soviet Union in 1977. A year later, his parents hung a banner out their window that said, "Let us go to our son in Israel." That request was answered with 5 years of exile in Siberia. Alexander and his brother Leonid both live in the United States now. Alexander completed medical school recently, and he's just begun his residency. Welcome to Fresh Air. Let's go back to the early 70s when you were still in the Soviet Union. I'd be interested in hearing how your parents became leaders of the Jewish emigration movement.
It was a very long process. Initially, there was no such desire to be a leader of a movement that didn't exist, actually, in the late 60s, early 70s. The idea of immigration came to my parents after the Six-Day War in Israel. They felt strongly about going to Israel, be with their people. And I think it was dictated by years of anti-Semitism that our family and our friends experienced through many years. So early 70s were the changing years for the whole family. I was just completing my high school education. And personally, I was following my father's steps, so to speak. He would give me literature to review. He would give me some reprinted materials that were not published in the Soviet Union, that were, you know, given from friends to friends to learn more about who we are, why we are Jews, and why we are persecuted.
Your parents became two of the leading dissidents in the Soviet Union, a lot of people who knew who they were. Your house became a gathering place for other dissidents and for people who wanted advice on how to get out of the Soviet Union. And I wonder if you, if your parents tried to keep you out of it, to keep you out of all of the political trouble that they were getting into.
No, not really. They didn't know what trouble are. They didn't know what's coming. We applied in 1970. And the first reaction was, of course, my parents lost their jobs. My father is an engineer, or he was an engineer at that time, and my mother is a physician. They both lost their jobs. That was the first blow from the authorities. And the trouble came probably at the same time, but we didn't have time to prepare. So I was not sheltered from it. I was involved as much as my mother and my father.
Your father became involved in a kind of catch-22. He lost his job and kept getting menial jobs, which was the only jobs he was basically allowed to have after that, and he'd be fired from those jobs. And apparently if you're out of work for more than 2 weeks, is it, you can be jailed for being a parasite?
Yes, it's a very tricky and very unfortunate and brutal Catch-22. As you mentioned, my father, and later I myself experienced the same thing when KGB representatives will come to your employer and they will demand that you will be fired because you influence the co-workers. And of course, you will be fired next day. And then somebody will show at your door and tell you that within 2 weeks they will start criminal procedures against you because you're now unemployed and you are declared as parasite of society. So you try hard to find a new position, and it doesn't last more than probably months. And this, the whole thing repeats itself.
Did you ever wish that your parents were better conformists, that that they weren't politically active and that they hadn't lost their jobs and that you could just live more calm life in the Soviet Union?
No, I don't think I would wish that, because the situation that we unfortunately experience now opened a lot of different characters that my parents possess that maybe would be dormant and never would be exposed. And I'm talking about determination and strength and support for others and love for others. We started, as I said, we started just because we wanted to leave. But then after harassment, after pressure from authorities, there was a natural reaction from our side. We tried to resist this pressure, and not only fighting for ourselves, but through this fight, my father became very experienced in, for example, legal means, using their own laws and their own regulations to defend himself, his family, and others who are in a similar situation. And pretty soon, other people who want to apply or who already applied and became endangered themselves started to come to my parents asking for support. That's how my father became known in the Soviet Union. That's how he became a leader. It wasn't elected position. It evolved naturally. The more hardship he and his friends experienced, the more knowledgeable he would become. There was a sincere respect from KGB, for example, towards my father, and it was stated by them on many occasions. They respected his approach. He never raised his voice. He never yells or argues. He never set up a scandal. He deals with them with their own weapon, which is Soviet law.
My guest is Alexander Slepak. He's a former Soviet refusnik who got out of the Soviet Union in 1977 and now is working to get his parents out of the Soviet Union. They are two of the Soviet Union's leading dissidents. You were a teenager at the time they started becoming active. What kind of work did you do? You started becoming active in the 70s as well. What could you do as a teenager?
After I finished high school, we applied shortly after that. That was one of the reasons we waited till 1970.
So you could finish high school first?
Yes, that was my mother's request, and we complied with that. And then after that, we applied, we were turned down, and so that I wouldn't waste any time, I wanted to continue my education. I applied to Moscow University to study biology. I was turned down. I tried again next year, and basically I was told by people from the KGB office that I will never get education and my efforts are useless. And when my parents lost their jobs and a final dismissal, so to speak, was between 71 and 72, so I became the only supporter of the family. Jobs were very diverse and meaningless, just a labor, hard labor job to get bread on the table.
What about political work, though?
Political work, educational, most of it. We didn't have any Xerox machines, which is illegal in Russia. Typewriters has to be registered with authorities. So we try to multiply books, information, addresses of people who are in need and who are in help, need help. And we would like to spread the word about our situation, to contact foreign press, to contact foreign governments through their embassies in Moscow. And we never thought that we are doing any illegal action. We never felt that we are doing some activity as now called dissent. We just wanted to protect ourselves and protect others. Personally, after, even before we applied, while I was in high school, I would go after school to a certain location and do photocopies of books page by page, and then use developer in the bathtub. And, you know, like we read in old books about old movements in other countries and in other places.
Did you have any direct run-ins with the KGB?
Yes, many times. There, most of them are unpleasant. Sometimes they want to talk sense to you. Sometimes they try to be very nice and polite, and they invite you, and they're dressed well, and they're very, very polite with you. On other occasions, they're brutal. They use physical strength. They assault you. They assault your relatives or your parents in front of you.
Did that happen to you?
Oh, yes, many times. Our apartment had been broken in many times without any warrant, and my parents were physically abused, and I was physically abused. Every time they take you to jail, the first interaction is physical. Then they talk to you. And that happened a lot.
You are Jewish, and part of the reason why you and your family wanted to leave the Soviet Union was because of anti-Semitism. Are you religious?
We all carry our God and ourselves. To me, the word religious means probably different than to everybody else or to others. In a sense of observing, no. My family now observes Shabbat. We go to the synagogue on high holidays, and we respect the basic traditions, yes. But as I said, religion grows in you. With your growth, your religion grows. If you are interested in my upbringing, no, there was no any religious education in my childhood. As well as my parents, they grew up in a Soviet society not knowing anything about religion or culture or traditions at all. So when we applied, we had to learn who we are as well as why we are persecuted.
So have you been becoming more interested in that since leaving the Soviet Union?
Oh, yes, yes, because the majority of the people that I meet here and people with whom I associate belong to the different temples, different communities, congregations. So, yes, definitely I learned much more.
You were allowed to leave the Soviet Union in 1977, and it was on the eve of the Belgrade Conference to review the Helsinki Accords. Do you think there was any political motivation in your getting out?
Yes. The Soviet authorities knew beforehand that our family case will be presented on Belgrade Conference as an example of violation of Helsinki Agreement signed 2 years prior to Belgrade meeting. So there was a political motivation. They wanted to take it off agenda, the question of immigration. And that's probably what allowed me to immigrate.
No, you were the only person given permission to leave from your family. And I believe on the day that you were given permission to leave, your brother received a draft notice.
Correct.
From the military, and he didn't want to serve, and he went underground for the next few years, underground until he was able to emigrate from the Soviet Union. Did you feel that this was a way of getting...
Even.
Right, yeah, of getting even at the same time that they were letting you out?
Yeah, they... the mentality of the Soviet government is quite... They like revenge. Revenge rules many actions. And another thing, arrest of my parents soon after I left. And they called my brother to the army because they let me out, because they had to let me go. But they didn't want to be perceived by themselves as losers of this confrontation.
Did you have to go through a period of guilt, thinking that that your freedom was won at the expense of your brothers and your parents?
Terrible. When I finally reached freedom, when I got to Israel, I couldn't buy anything in the supermarket. I couldn't eat foods that I saw. I couldn't absorb the fact that there are several selections of meats and fruit and vegetable and all these overwhelming amount of food and goods. And why I'm saying food, because it's interesting, but that's basically what you really need when you live in Russia. Clothing, you can get used to wear the same thing over and over again, but you want diversity of food, and you know that there is something else that you don't have. And it wouldn't go, you know, it would get stuck.
Yeah.
I felt terrible. I felt terrible. I wanted to set up packages and send it to Moscow to everybody that I left behind. Guilt, you're right. Feeling, why me? Why I'm better than others? What if I can go back and instead of me, my parents will come here?
There must have been also this incredible sense of responsibility that you bore, that since you were the one that was let out, that you had to achieve, that you had to make a life that was worth what it took to win.
Yes, exactly. And still, even now, till this very day, I have the duty to get my parents out. I was sent here by chance, by luck, by circumstances, and now it's up to me what will happen to my parents. I know I can do a certain amount of work. I cannot move mountains, but at least I can try to get them out. And every time something is, you know, twinkling on the horizon, it gives me hope. And I learn not to be very optimistic, but at the same time, when things are looking good, you know, my heart is pounding every time there are news about my parents.
I want to talk to you more about your efforts to get your parents out of the Soviet Union, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Alexander Slepak, and he emigrated from the Soviet Union in 1977. His parents, Vladimir and Maria, are two leading Soviet dissidents and refuseniks, and Alexander's working to get them out of the Soviet Union. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Alexander Slepak is my guest. Before we get into the recent work that you're doing to get your parents released, I'm interested in the fact that you went to Israel first before coming to America. Did you not want to stay in Israel?
Oh, no. I'm an American citizen. I came to Israel because I wanted to, and I consider myself an Israeli. I came to the United States for my education. On my arrival to Israel, my Hebrew wasn't adequate for me to continue education. And when I made up my mind to continue to study rather than find a job, I felt that it would be better if I'll start in English. Besides, I heard, being in Israel, that when you get a medical degree from the United States, it's very strong and valid.
So you plan on going back at some future date?
Oh, sure.
Okay. You've been working to try to get your parents out of the Soviet Union, and you've tried many different techniques, from meeting with, I think you met with George Shultz.
Yes.
You had a 17-day hunger strike. I don't know what other efforts you've been making, but have you been trying a scattershot campaign, figuring that eventually something something might work?
I'm trying to follow very closely the international events, and whenever there is an opportunity of negotiations or direct contacts with the Soviet government, to use that opportunity. The strongest, of course, the strongest influence on the government of the Soviet Union at this day and age is relations with the United States government. So I'm very fortunate to be in the United States at this time. And I'm talking about Gorbachev reforms and Gorbachev era in general.
Well, how much do you think that the Gorbachev reforms will help refuseniks in the Soviet Union?
Their hopes and their results. I can tell you that numbers did increase, numbers of immigrants who are allowed to leave the Russia. But at the same time, we cannot be fooled by numbers, because there are even larger numbers still remaining there, and people are kept there by force. But at least there is an attempt to show to the West that Gorbachev administration will try to use his reforms and to use the situation of immigration as a tool of negotiating or, let's say, putting pressure on the relations.
Your parents are, I guess, in their 60s now?
Yes.
And their health is not good. I've read about several dissidents and older people from the Soviet Union, younger people as well, who came to America expecting a new and better life, and who were very disappointed with what they found here, and found themselves missing family that they left behind and friends that they left behind so much that they went back or considered going back. And I wonder if you've thought about that at all in how that might affect your parents, how they would feel if they actually got out and moved here.
Well, you see, when you decide to immigrate, when you decide to cut off your roots and flight on the new land, it's not just, as we here, go to some other country just to visit, just to see. Let's try it, and then we come back. When you do that in Russia, it means that you are cutting forever, you burn your bridges. If you're young, ambitious, well-educated, you have better chances to survive in whatever land you will end up eventually. For older people, it's a much more difficult challenge. And I accept the fact that a lot of immigrants who reach other lands, and let's say United States, are not very happy. They cannot adjust to the new society. They cannot adjust to new culture, to way of life, and just a look at life. Many of immigrants have trouble finding jobs. The most difficult thing for them is to learn how to take care of themselves, to plan their budgets so they don't end up in the street after not paying rent, to find the best education for their children, and to find the best working place for themselves. In Russia, all that I mentioned was done by the government. On one hand, people don't have their own initiative there, and they are just led like puppets. On the other hand, when you are led by as a puppet all your life and then suddenly strings are cut, you have to find the strength to get up on your own without strings. That's hard. That's very difficult.
Have you tried to live in an emigre community in America so that you could be in touch with people from the Soviet Union and people who speak Russian and who know Russian culture?
No. As a matter of fact, when I got out of Russia, I made it very clear to myself that I basically reborn, that whatever happened to me in my first 25 years of life, it was a terrible bad dream. I want to draw the experience of those years, but I don't want to carry it with me as a burden. So I tried to, let's say, assimilate in a new society, to become part of it, not to dwell and not to remember and not to compare how was it there compared to what it's here, not to engulf in nostalgia. I left behind a lot of good, a lot of friends, a lot of cherished places, a lot of favorable corners in Moscow that I will never be able to visit again. But there is another life here. And I tried to stay away from the Russian community, not because I have negative feelings toward the Russian community. I just wanted to start a new life on different terms, as an American or as an Israeli, as somebody who lives among neighbors and shares neighbors' life.
What kind of contact do you have with your parents now? Can you pick up the phone and call them?
Yes, fortunately, yes. Before, let's say 5 years ago, it was very difficult for me to get in touch with them on the phone. Even now, my letters are intercepted, as well as my parents' letters. So we don't rely so much on mail as on phone contact. And so far, I've been fortunate that whenever I want to talk to them, I can.
We only have a few seconds left, but do you find yourself becoming really optimistic about them getting out, or do you try to not let yourself become optimistic so that you're not disappointed if you don't succeed in getting them out?
Well, as I told you before we started the show, that, you know, I learned to look at things the way they come. Probably through the years I developed the crust on myself, so it doesn't hurt when things don't get the way I want them. Every time I'm getting optimistic, yes, correct, and every time I'm very hopeful and I don't sleep the night before the big event, and the next event is possibly the summit between Gorbachev and Reagan, and again my hopes are high, and if not, I'll try again.
Alexander Slepak, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alexander Slepak, and he emigrated from the Soviet Union in 1977, first to Israel and then to America. His parents, Vladimir and Maria, are two of the Soviet Union's leading dissidents and refuseniks. Alexander is working to get them out of the Soviet Union. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with artist Red Grooms, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with singer Dion DiMucci. Dion's best known for his hits like The Wanderer and Runaround Sue, but in the past few years, he's also become a star in Christian music. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis reviews the latest album from clarinetist and composer John Carter. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the latest program from the Showtime cable network, Showtime Coast to Coast. It's a variety show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of a new album from clarinetist and composer John Carter, Dance of the Love Ghosts. It's the third in Carter's series of five suites titled Roots and Folklore.
John Carter has no serious competition as the leading clarinetist in jazz. He's also emerging as a composer of great stature. Dance of the Love Ghosts, Carter's latest album on Gramavision Records, features both an unusual instrumentation and an intriguing personnel. Along with Carter and trumpeter Bobby Bradford, Carter's longtime associate, the personnel includes bass clarinetist Marty Ehrlich, violinist Terry Janor, bassist Fred Hopkins, drummer Andrew Surreal, and two musicians one might not expect to chance upon in such a cerebral context, the former Count Basie trombonist Benny Powell, and former Mothers of Invention keyboard player Don Preston. Preston's synthesizer washes bless this album with even more orchestral sweep than its two predecessors. Preston's electronics represent a significant departure for Carter. Dance of the Love Ghosts also marks Carter's first experiments with African percussion, lyrics, and spoken text, all of which he uses in a spare but imaginative manner. It's a difficult album to excerpt, because each of its five tracks is so structurally sound from beginning to end, and because the recurrence of certain key themes gives it the integrity of a seamless, extended work. But I want you to listen to some of Dance of the Love Ghosts in hope of persuading you to hear it in its entirety. We'll hear the beginning of a track called Journey. This is John Carter's attempt to evoke what is sometimes called the Middle Passage, the journey from Africa to America aboard slave ships. The featured soloist is trombonist Benny Powell, who uses the entire range of his horn and acquits himself admirably in an unfamiliar setting. But Powell isn't the whole show here. There are other things to listen for, including Fred Hopkins' hypnotic bass ostinato and Andrew Surreal's sensitive cymbal splashes. There are also examples of John Carter's ingenuity as a composer. 2.5 minutes into the piece, you'll hear the main theme, a repetitious siren-like phrase that the reeds introduce in counterpoint to the bass. This phrase is the album's unifying thread. Thank you. Journey from John Carter's Dance of the Love Ghosts, a remarkable album on many levels, the most stimulating of which is Carter's use of compositional strategies associated with European classical music to tell the story of the African diaspora. In that sense, it's melting pot music, like all great jazz, from ragtime on. But it's also the kind of music that sounds nothing like jazz to some listeners. Older bop or swing fans might denounce it as noise, whereas younger fans whose first exposure to jazz came during the frenetic, solo-oriented 60s are likely to denounce it as too European because of its emphasis on composition. It goes to show that the word jazz has outlived its usefulness. We need another term, and new music simply won't do, because the classical music avant-garde has already stretched it to the breaking point. Maybe the best thing to call Dance of the Love Ghosts is modern American music and let it go at that. But whatever one chooses to call it, it's electrifying.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed John Carter's new album, Dance of the Love Ghosts. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dion DiMucci. Dion's hits included Teenager in Love, Runaround Sue, The Wanderer, and Abraham Martin and John. Fans lost track of Dion since the 60s, although for the last few years he's been recording Christian music. He's beginning a commercial comeback that started in June with a sellout concert at Radio City Music Hall. When I spoke with Dion from the studios of WLRN in Miami, where Dion now lives, he told me that his first musical influence was the country sound of Hank Williams. Then he heard rock and roll.
The first rock and roll I heard was like the Crows singing, you know, G and, you know, street corner groups, you know. And I went wild. I just started hanging out at the backstage at the Apollo Theater to cop some riffs off the Moon Glows and the Heartbeats and the Cadillacs and, you know, all those early street corner groups.
Did you have street corner harmony groups before you started recording?
Oh, yeah. There were a bunch of guys in my neighborhood and from, you know, different neighborhoods in Bronx, New York City that just took to the listening to the jukebox and learning the harmonies, and I kind of gathered up the best street corner singers in Bronx, New York City, and formed the group, and that was the beginning of Dion and the Belmonts, and we sang everywhere.
How did you get to make your first recording?
Well, a friend in Bronx, New York City, there was this songwriter who had a friend who had a brother who knew a guy who was opening up a record company. It was called Lori Records, and he just liked us, and we started recording, you know.
No, I love you like I do. No, I do.
Like you were really living the life that you sung about. Did you feel like the character of your songs, or was that more of a persona to you?
Well, like what song?
Well,
you mean if they
I'm
were
thinking
personal?
Of The Wanderer, I guess, especially.
Well, actually, The Wanderer was written about a character that hung up on the street corners of Bronx, New York City, in George's Bar. This guy had tattoos all over his body. Like on his left arm, he had this girl's name, Janie, tattooed because he was dating her. And then he started going out with Mary. So he had Janie covered up with a panther, and he got Rosie tattooed on his chest. And every time he dated another girl, he'd get these tattoos covered up. So he ended up with a whole bunch of tattoos all over his body. And the guy was a character. So we wrote this song called The Wanderer, you know. Flo on my left arm and Jeannie on my right, and Mary is the girl that I'll be with tonight. When she asks me which one I love the best,
I tear over my shirt and I show a rosy on my chest, cause I'm a wanderer, yeah, a wanderer.
It was assumed in the late 50s and the early 60s that rock and roll singers, when they grew up and became adults, had to learn how to do pop standards and show tunes so that they could play Vegas. And I think, in a way, Bobby Darin was the model for that.
Yeah.
Were you expected to do that when you, you know, as you were getting a little bit older?
Yes, yes. And I be honest with you, it kind of threw me. You know, back then, when you're that young, you want to be accepted, and you think people know better, and you sometimes give up a piece of yourself just to please them.
You had a drug habit starting when you were pretty young, I think. How did that affect you when you were coming of age and recording? Did that when did you realize it was a problem?
Well, I always used drugs. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I think I started using drugs when I was 13, you know. The records and the rock and roll career was almost a diversion. And when things were slowing down, I think I got more involved in the drugs again, trying to fill that emptiness. Emotionally, I was really stuck, and I didn't know how to get out of it. And I think... In 1968, April 1st, 1968, man, I just said a prayer. I said, God, help me. I don't know what's going on, but I need some help. And ever since that day, I haven't had a drug or a drink or a cigarette. It just took it right out of me. And I think from that moment on, I started growing spiritually. And I think that's what was missing.
So that's when you started getting religious?
If you want to use that word, I don't consider myself religious, but I would consider myself a man of prayer, trying to grow spiritually.
For the past few years, you've been singing and recording Christian songs, and probably a lot of your fans from years ago aren't even aware of the records you've been recording for the past few years. Is that true?
I know. Yes, it's very true. And how I found that out is I did a concert up at Radio City Music Hall, and it sold out, like, immediately. Now, I could do a concert in Long Island the week before for maybe a Christian promoter who's putting together kind of a concert for the churches being advertised, you know, and 4,000 people will show up. But I think it's like almost like a different person, you know, because I do come up with a lot of the material I did on the last 5 albums for Word Music. And not that I neglect the old songs, but they're not Exhibit A in the concerts I've been doing over the last 10 years.
There's a new breed of man
there are so many rock singers who have been so influenced by you, including Bruce Springsteen. Do you hear that a lot from performers? Do performers tell you how much you meant to them when they were starting out?
Yes, I hear that all the time. It's hard to relate to. You know, when I did Radio City Music Hall, Paul Schaefer came by and played piano, and the E Street Band, Steve Van Zandt was there, and just a bunch of people got up there. And you know, when you go out and talk to some of these new performers, they tell you how you encourage them and you influence them, and it's just hard to relate to. But
why is it hard to relate to?
I don't know. It's just, you know, I know who inspired me. I accept it, but it's just hard to relate to. I don't know why.
Well, Dion, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your life.
Thanks, Terry.
Dion's next appearance is on August 28th at the Sands Hotel in Atlantic City. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories do you have coming up today?
Terry, we have more today on the case of convicted spy Clayton Lone Tree, and we'll be looking into the appeal process in a military court. We also look back at the life and the work of Bayard Rustin, a black civil rights activist, longtime activist, who died today. We'll be announcing the winner in our China movie contest today. Also, you, as you will probably remember, Terry, 20th Century Fox had agreed to send to the People's Republic of China a movie a week, 52 movies. We ask listeners to tell us what they would send if they had the chance to give the Chinese a look at the real America.
So that's coming up tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many types of programs that used to be staples of television programming have disappeared. Occasionally, a genre that's gone out of fashion returns. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review of a new cable program that may help revive the variety show.
Once upon a time, TV was nothing but westerns. Now there isn't a western series to be found. The networks produced so many so fast they glutted the market until viewers got sick of them. So the western will be dead until one brave network revives it by coming up with a good one. 10 years ago, cop shows were everywhere. Then they disappeared, and now they're back. The sitcom was pronounced dead until NBC presented The Cosby Show. Now there are more warm sitcoms in the 80s than there were blazing westerns in the 50s. The anthology show was dead until Steven Spielberg agreed to do Amazing Stories for NBC. Then suddenly the anthology show was alive again, with George Burns' Comedy Week and new episodes of The Twilight Zone and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. 2 short years later, and the anthology show is dead again. Long live the anthology show. But nothing has died so quickly and been so dormant as the variety show. In the 50s, with Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, the variety show was king. In the 60s and 70s, the Carol Burnett Show was queen and remains the last truly successful series of its kind. The variety show was murdered, though, by a supply that far outweighed the demand. The popularity of Sonny and Cher's variety show in the 60s convinced the networks that anyone with a hit single could handle a series, and the genre was doomed. Cher survived it, the variety show, and Sonny didn't. This season, ABC will try again with The Dolly Show, giving Dolly Parton a shot at doing for variety what Bill Cosby did for the sitcom. Meanwhile, one of the best variety shows since Great American Dream Machine premieres this week, poking its head out timidly to check out the territory. The program is called Showtime Coast to Coast, and it premieres Saturday night on the Showtime cable network. That's why Showtime's in the title. Coast to Coast is in the title because producer Ken Ehrlich's concept of the show is to go where the talent is, popping up at live concerts and festivals all over the country, sneaking into recording studios, and hanging out at nightclubs. It's not quite variety of the Ed Sullivan variety. I mean, there are no talking hands or spinning plates. But there's a mixture of familiar talent, new faces, and fresh approaches that's really appealing. The premiere of Showtime Coast to Coast goes into the recording studio with Manhattan Transfer. It attends the 1987 Jazz and Heritage Festival in New Orleans, checks out a couple of comedians, and mounts a special musical super session in which Joni Mitchell, Bobby McFerrin, David Sanborn, and Wayne Shorter improvise beautifully. But the thrill of the first show for me was being introduced to K.D. Lang, who's billed as a new wave country singer from Canada, and whose voice is jazzy, bluesy, and magnificent. She opens the show and sings three songs, one rock, one rockabilly, one blues. I'll shut up for a while so you can hear her let loose on Write Me in Care of the Blues. If Coast to Coast continues to showcase talent like that, it deserves a long run and a loyal following. Not everything in the show was to my liking, but I guess that's why they call it variety. Now if someone could just get to work on the Western.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. He reviewed the new cable variety show, Showtime Coast to Coast. Last night I heard a ruckus down the road. I had no time to lose, and so away I go. I saw the lights, heard the trucks and audio. Here's a look at tomorrow's program. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with poet Mark Halliday. His poetry owes as much to doo-wop and pop radio as it does to other poets. Rock historian Ed Ward will profile guitarist Steve Cropper, who gave rock one of its greatest guitar riffs in Sam and Dave's Soul Man. And book critic John Leonard will review Cloak and Gown, an examination of how Yale graduates and professors compromised academia by working for the CIA. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.